Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 3rd of August and it is episode 71. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Aaron Kwong, who is with the IPA as part of the Lion Rock Institute Scholarship Program. Mm-hmm. Going to be learning a lot about Hong Kong, where that's going, sort of history. Really interesting chat.
In case you're wondering.
In case you were wondering, yes. And it was very interesting.
Oh,
like,
terrific.
It was a free market paradise. It's no longer that. And, you know, it's like, what are the debates going on there at the moment?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the differences between debates in Hong Kong and in China versus the debates in Australia?
We'd have Hong Kong listeners for sure.
Oh, absolutely. We have Swedish listeners, and Hong Kong is closer to Australia than Sweden.
If you look at that.
Yeah.
The science on that is settled.
Absolutely.
And it's sure to double in the future now that we've started covering Hong Kong.
I think so, at least. And we're also going to be talking to IPA Research Fellow Matthew Lesh. So he's had an article this week talking about how young people aren't exactly social justice warriors, mm-hmm. which is what the conversation was running with, and also what it was like being in Britain when all the Brexit stuff from a few weeks ago went down.
Lots of inside takes.
Yes, man. Inside, definitely. He was at the speeches.
He's a very well-connected young man.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Cool, so let's get into some stories. Unfortunately, we're down a team member this week.
We are.
Let's address the elephant in the room. We are missing a team member. So Nina's sick today, so I am behind the board pressing all the buttons. So if you do hear anything that doesn't sound right, then that just shows how much we need Nina.
Yeah, or it could be just something we said. But
no. I'm blameless. So it's all about Nina not being here.
If this is not recording,
yeah,
that's because Nina's not here.
It's definitely recording.
Hope so.
Absolutely. like the Rowan Dean interview. A bit of podcast history was when I got about 6 minutes into a Rowan Dean interview and realized I forgot to press record.
It was the best 6 minutes we ever did.
And it'll be lost. Yeah. It's the lost Nixon tapes of this podcast, but good versions. Anyway, let's get into some stories this week. Yeah. So if I may start, Pete.
Oh, go for it, mate.
Yeah. All right. So plastic bags.
Oh, now. Okay.
Now, this is the emotional roller coaster of the week. So, on Wednesday, Coles hoisted the white flag. They said that they're going to give away plastic bags for free.
Yeah.
Flag of victory. The plastic bag waving in the air of victory.
Yeah.
So, they said it was going to be free. They looked like they backflipped on the whole 15 cent thing. It was going to be a victory. And then we all were like, Woolworths is going to come next. And then Woolworths comes out and they say, no, we're going to stay. Making people pay for plastic bags.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we're like, well, that's the death of Woolworths. And we thought we were on the right path until Thursday.
So that's one day for those.
That is one day if you're keeping up. So less than 24 hours later, this came out. So supermarket giant Coles has today announced yet another twist in its plastic bag saga. Just one day after News Corp revealed Coles had announced an indefinite handing out of free reusable bags, they have now done yet another backflip with the supermarket CEO, John Durkin, sending out a message to all Coles staff, 115,000 of them, that we are extending our complimentary bag offer until Wednesday, 29 August for our customers. I appreciate this is a good quote. So I appreciate this transition phase is taking longer than anticipated, but it is absolutely the right thing to do by our customers. Look, John.
There's one thing.
Come on. You do not care about your customers. under no circumstance. You care about your bottom line.
Yeah, fine.
And you have the pretense of caring about the environment.
Yeah.
You do not care about your customers.
Yeah, John.
This is...
No. Pull the other one, mate. I think Coles deserve credit, though, for inventing a new thing. We've seen people, you know, cave in to pressure.
Yep.
This is the double cave.
The cave out.
Yeah. So you know, they deserve credit for inventing a new social phenomenon. The thing that I'm worrying about, though, is that will this just not go on forever? Look, I'm not sure how their decision-making process works in there, but surely there's going to be another backlash.
I don't know if John Durkin knows how the decision-making process goes on in there. You're not alone.
Well, yeah.
Sorry, so, continue your thought.
Well, it's going to just sweep back and forth. I mean, now there's going to be another, you know, the punters will go nuts again.
Yeah, so...
And then presumably they'll...
Yeah, like, in my head, if I'm thinking that they're doing... Like, they're still in control of what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
they are just going to keep backflipping until one side of the debate, the pro-plastic bags versus anti-plastic bags, until one side of the debate runs out of steam on protesting, and then they'll just go with the other side.
Yeah, so like,
it's our turn to get outraged to the backflip until they backflip again, and then it's the anti-plastic bag brigade, their turn to get angry until there's another backflip, and it just keeps going back and forth like a hit of tennis.
That's right, and even if they're charging like half the time, that's still heaps of money for them.
Yeah, absolutely. But they haven't charged yet, so they just keep delaying. Like, it's August 29 now. Oh, they charged for that 1 week and then got rid of it. Yeah.
Well, I'm a Woolies man. Well, now I'm an Aldi man, but
Well, I think I have to go Aldi. I was like saying, would you rather shop at Coles and just be in? Would you rather shop at Coles and have them like, you know, inconsistently annoy you, or go to Woolworths and at least you know you're going to be angry?
Yeah, at least.
I can at least preface how I'm going to feel leaving the store.
It's good to have no chance of happiness, isn't it? Because if you've got a chance, that's what gets you. It's that chance.
It's the loss. It's the opportunity cost.
The other thing it does, it allows young IPA podcast listeners to smartly explain to people that actually this is not bad for the environment, not good for the environment.
Yeah, okay, so if you're new to the show and you don't know why that's true, it's because these 15-cent plastic bags that they're now handing out actually use more plastic. And I think the stat was you have to use it 100 times for you to break even with single-use plastic bags.
For 50 to 130 times, you have to use the so-called environmentally friendly bags to break even. I've got 27 of them, so...
That's a hell of a box full.
Yeah, I've got to do a lot of shopping.
Big party at your house this weekend.
That's right.
The plastic bags.
Yeah, exactly right. And the other thing is, as we know, that there's evidence to suggest it's bad for your health using the same bag carrying the food.
Oh, yeah, because all the bacteria goes. Yeah.
Why do they charge you like $15 for punching a dozer in this country, but they're happy for people to carry, what is it, meningococcal around in their, you know, shopping bags?
Punch a dozer.
Anyway.
What a moment for this podcast. All right, let's move on to another story. Well, yeah, we'll just keep covering this every time there's a backflip.
Yeah, this
so
is good. Good for us. Know.
Maybe we release a special 15-minute episode of the podcast tomorrow afternoon when there's another announcement made. So
it keeps Gideon Rosner in a job. So that's
absolutely
important. All right, so let's move on to the Trump growth figures this week, or the US growth figures. So late last week, it was after the podcast went out, which is why we didn't report it, the US Department of Commerce announced growth for the second quarter in the state, which was at 4.1% pace. So what that means is it doesn't mean the US economy grew 4.1%. In that quarter, it means that the growth in that quarter is on 4.1% pace for the year. Does that make sense to you?
It does to me. Now, but one thing I need to know is that above average or is that regular?
That's very high.
There we go.
Okay, so the common view amongst economists is that, you know, that the US just no longer grows that quickly. And if you remember, this was a Trump campaign promise, you know, we're going to grow the economy at 4%. We featured it in your hay yesterday, Paul Krugman, who's a very famous...
Krugman.
I asked Morgan how to pronounce it.
And he absolutely sold you over a barrel.
He said he didn't know. He said he didn't know when I gave up. So,
oh, okay, fair enough.
we finished a video in March 2017, Paul Krugman saying... Krugman saying...
You got it, man. I believe in you.
K-R-U-G. There's nothing in policy that would raise...
Big P. Just go on P.
Yeah, okay, big P. There's nothing in policy... So he said, there's nothing in policy that would raise the growth rate above 3% ever again in the United States. Nothing in policy.
Yeah.
Nothing you could possibly do.
Not one.
That could help economic growth. Obviously, there's a range of reasons why this result has been achieved, but clearly cutting taxes, reducing regulation helps.
Yeah, if you guys know Paul Krugman, like, this guy has never seen a government policy he didn't like, so I don't think he would have known to, like, when he says there's no policy, it's because, like, lowering taxes just genuinely did not occur to him as an option.
Yeah.
Like, he just, like, why would you do that?
Doesn't make
lower
sense.
Lower things. No.
In that interview, he's like, oh, we should build infrastructure, which, you know, may or may not be true, but, yeah.
All right, cool.
But I should point out, just to make this point more fully, in all seriousness, like, you know, we're having a bit of fun with Paul Krugman. This is not meant to be possible anymore, right? Like, the growth in the United States... All these economists were saying, you know, it's never going to grow above 3% because the aging population, you know, productivity is not going to keep going up, blah, 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 blah. So it is a good result. Should point out, obviously, it's only one quarter.
Yeah, so we don't know if it's going to keep going, but it's pretty good. And like, obviously, like, we've boosted up the corporate taxes. Like, with the corporate tax reforms, that's going to be boosted pretty quickly, but might not hold on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we don't know, but hopefully it continues.
All right, cool. I've got another story here. So this one might take a bit of setup here because a lot of moving parts to it. But basically...
Set it up.
Thank you. So this week, The Guardian UK... The Guardian, had a front page story. A right-wing think tank has been offering potential US donors access to government ministers and civil servants as it raises cash for research to support the free trade deals demanded by hardline Brexiters, according to an investigation. Yeah. Now, that is single buzzword hammered into one paragraph.
Yeah.
So what it is, Institute of Economic Affairs, really great organization out in the UK. We've got a lot of friends over there. They're really cool, free market stuff. If you are listening to us in Britain or if you want to get involved in British things, like, can't think of a better place to go. But anyway, they were the victims of, like, this, you know, I guess a sting operation would be the way to describe it, if you can describe it as such, by Greenpeace. And they wanted to know, like, how much is this evil organization influencing British politics.
Yeah.
So they set up this meeting with a guy who works there and then blabbed about it to The Guardian. And yeah, the best things they could come up with was that, like, occasionally government ministers come to IEA events of their own free will and that they elicit donations.
Yeah.
From people who are interested.
I'm sure you're going to say, but the bloke's response was fantastic.
It was. We'll get to that. But I also want to point out, sorry, The Guardian, about like six paragraphs into the article, they say, these disclosures are likely to raise fresh questions about the independence and status of the IEA. Like, that's the ultimate, we don't actually have anything. Because it's like, these might raise questions. Yeah. We're not raising the questions, but I'm just saying, one day, someone might raise a question about whether they're independent. Not us, but someone.
It's almost like they're influenced by their philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. So so this comes out. So Mark Littlewood, the guy at the center of it, the IEA guy, he writes a blog on how it happens. So here's the story. So we go to this conference in, I think it's Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. Mark Littlewood's there. Sorry?
Great spot.
I haven't been. Mark Littlewood is there. Sorry. He starts talking to the an attendee by the name of Tom DeLacy, who was registered from a group called Trade is Great, although he explained he was actually with a different PR firm. Now,
that's Greenpeace going on like this.
I'm just like, you don't meet with that guy. That is the fakest name in the history of the planet.
I don't
like,
know.
Just call yourself Greenpeace Sting Operation. Like, that is as... much
I might meet with him. I'd be like, this is a you know, grassroots
trade
guy.
Is great.
That's Greenpeace thinking, what do the IEA think? Oh, this is their philosophy. Pretty much nailed it, to be honest.
That's fair enough. All right, so I just think that is a fact. Like, if you call your organization Trade is Great,
free market,
free market super. Okay, so this way, so then he meets with Tom DeLacy in London, and Tom DeLacy's asking all these questions about ministerial access and donations. Yeah. And, you know, Mark Littlewood says, like, I didn't think this guy was great, but, you know, the concept of a minister going to an event hosted by a free market think tank or any think tank, not that controversial.
No.
Like, they just have the event in London and they go, that's an interesting speaker, or that's an interesting thind. Like, it happens to us. I'm sure it happens to the Australian Institute, the Grattan Institute. Yeah. I could go on.
It's how civil society operates.
That is how civil society, and that's how marketplace of ideas works. Like, you have the event, people go, and, you know, hopefully people turn up and think. And yeah, so at the end of the article, Mark Littlewood says, it's surely uncontroversial that the IEA's principles coincide with the interests of our donors. A cursory look at other think tanks would confirm this. Again, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's like a non-story, but it got a lot of play in the British press. It's like, oh my God, look at the IEA. It's one of those ones where it's like, if it's a left-wing organization and they've got ministers, it's like, well, this is how the democratic process works. But it's the right wing. It's like, these are the evil people.
Yeah.
And they're conspiring to bring us down.
Yeah, it's subversion. Subversion of the democracy.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
No, you go.
Well, what I like about this is that Greenpeace, they used to be like these chilled out hippies sitting around talking about the environment. Now they're hardcore.
They are sting operators.
Covert ops.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know,
good on them.
Well, I just think, because like, I just think like, this will probably, like, someone in Australia has read this article and gone, I should do this to the IPA. So this is a shout out to IPA staff members who listen to this podcast. Hopefully that's all of them. Do not meet with any group called Trade is Great or any of the other ones Peter put forward.
Yeah, like, free market,
Free market super, don't meet with them. They are Greenpeace.
Yeah.
Cool. So I got one more story here. So Bernie Sanders in a bit of hot water this week. So Bernie Sanders, obviously, like, Bernie Sanders, he's a guy, loves single payer healthcare kind of thing. He wants universal healthcare. So basically his plans would see the federal government replace private health insurance that Americans currently receive as a benefit of employment or purchase independently, and would have the federal government become responsible for the current state level healthcare spending. So more government spending in healthcare. So universal healthcare. That's his idea.
Yeah.
It would cost $32 trillion over the next 10 years.
Okay.
That's a spicy meatball.
Well, they've grown at 4% this quarter. So.
Yeah, so they might have time to favor it. So that is the takeaway from a new study released by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University in the US. It's a free market think tank. Now, they do some really cool work as well, so go check that out. Especially Don Bordeaux's blog, Cafe Hayek.
Wow.
That thing is great. Oh, we got a lot of good stuff for hay over that from that blog. But anyway, so let me crunch down what $32 trillion is over 10 years, Pete. That is twice America's annual GDP, 54 times the annual defense spending, over 8 times the annual federal budget, and 281 times the private sector's annual medical research and development. Don't think they've got the money.
So how many times? 8 times the federal budget.
8 times the federal budget is what I've got here.
So he thinks we have to increase the federal budget by 8.
To be just to do health. Yes, but to be fair to Bernie Sanders, I don't think he knew.
That's being fair to him.
That's being. I don't want to say this, but I think the socialist politician probably didn't do the economic crunching.
Yeah, well, I mean, it'd be pretty hard to work out how big the budget is.
Yeah, absolutely. 4% though. So and we've got time.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we'll go into our interview. Oh, sorry, here's what else the IPA was up to this week. So you can go to our website, ipa.org.au, if you want to read it all. So we've got Daniel Wild and Simon Breeny. They spoke to send an inquiry into business investment. So you can go read his opening statements there. They did not meet the mustard for Jed Kearney, who was on the panel. Mm. She tweeted a fair few things afterwards about how outraged she was that we called for corporate taxes to be zero as an ideal number.
That's unfortunate.
That is unfortunate. So if you want to go read Dan and Simon's statement, that's up on our website now. You've also got Andrew Bushnell. So a lot of our Victorian listeners might have seen the Ryan Wells thing, which is like the three blokes outside a pub and one of them just shoulder charges someone. Elbows them. And then that guy got bail, which is a bit concerning.
Because he's definitely
not going to do it again.
He's safe on the streets.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, he will never get drunk and do cocaine and do that to someone again.
He was literally on a street.
Yeah.
And smashed someone in the head for no reason at all.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, obviously, we think this guy should not have got bail. If you want to read Andrew Bushnell talk about this sort of stuff and why it shows that our criminal justice system isn't working, that's also on our website. Over on our Facebook page, we've got some videos from a few of our media appearances this week. So Daniel Wild was on Sky News talking about how we should get out of Paris. That video got pretty popular. You can go watch that. And you can also watch Gideon Rosner just have a go at the Australian Navy for that. You see that pink nail polish thing?
I did.
Yeah, probably not for the show because it's a bit old news now. But if you want to see Gideon Rosner get the boot stuck into it, that was pretty funny.
Wasn't Gideon shade.
No. That shouldn't be anyone's shade. It was pretty ugly colour of pink. So you can go on that. Now, this is where I'd normally cross to Nina to plug a membership, but she's not here. So if you guys want to become a member of the IPA, Australia's loudest voice for freedom, you can go to ipa.org.au/join. Mm-hmm. The IPA only does what it does because of the support of our members and donors. So if you're already a member and you want to donate, you can go to ipa.org.au/donate. And for this podcast, thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify.
Yeah.
And through our website. So make sure you're subscribed to anyone that you prefer, and make sure you're getting your friends to subscribe through any that they prefer. Our Spotify numbers are starting to go up as the word gets out, so keep that one spreading. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you leave us a 5-star review and you can leave us a comment.
Not bad, but I think Nina does it better.
I think so. Yeah, she's got more energy to it, I suppose, because she is the director of our membership program,
yep.
And I'm sort of reading this off a sheet of paper and getting out of breath. But anyway, let's go to those interviews now. Sure. Okay, we now welcome back to the show, IPA Research Fellow Matthew Lesh. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
It's got a pocket square on. You can't say that because this is a audio.
We'll do an Instagram post.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We will.
Great 5 seconds. Great start to the interview there, Pete. cool. So, Matthew, big week for you. Wednesday, you had an article in the Spectator Australia. Basically, the Conversation had written an article talking about how there was... nearly 60% of young children are social justice activists, was basically the theory. A future full of Ellen Ayerson's. Now, that's a specific reference that I didn't quite get at first. What's the Ellen Ayerson angle? What was that story?
Okay, so Ellen Ayerson is a Swedish 21-year-old who stood up in a plane which was departing Sweden for Turkey, which had a returned asylum seeker on the plane. Now, as Douglas Murray has pointed out, the phenomenal story here was that Sweden had actually deported a failed asylum seeker. But in this case, she was an activist against deportations and she stood up on the plane in order to prevent this gentleman being deported. So it couldn't take off because they legally can't take off if no one's sitting down. Ironically, of course, I understand that the person she was trying to prevent wasn't actually on the plane. It was somebody else completely different who she ended up saving temporarily from deportation. But anyway, this has been used by the usual sources as, oh, isn't this great activism? You know, a time of pure evil and disgust to the world. Somebody's finally doing something. Mm. Anyway, so the Conversation, which is supposed to be academically rigorous in their opinion pieces, and they only let you publish if you're an academic affiliated with the university, published this article saying nearly 60% of academics are social justice activists.
60% of young people.
60% of young people, which is going to make you think about the amazing levels of engagement amongst young people if there's that many of them. But unfortunately,
Specifically activists. Not even just like, oh, you know, I support them, but I'm not exactly going to go to a rally. It's like 60% of people are at that rally.
Yeah, yeah. which doesn't really pass the muster if you're thinking about it quickly. But it turns out it came from a survey which was done a couple of years ago by Ipsos Mori in the UK, which found that 58% of young people had some kind of social engagement, which could kind of include volunteering or could have included kind of signing a petition online. It doesn't exactly make
what about like a Facebook activist share? Because that would clock the numbers up very quickly.
I think that might have counted for the definition, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it didn't even say that...
What about the pirate club at uni?
They were necessary... Was that your club?
They shared the Coney video back in 2012. Yeah. That would pump the numbers up so quickly.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the other part of it, of course, was the fact that it said the survey was just about broad social activity. It didn't actually necessarily mean that they're a social justice activist. They could have actually been a conservative Brexit supporter who went and campaigned on the Brexit campaign and would have counted in that survey. So if we're doing a fact check here, which I think sometimes a conversation needs, I think the correct disposition is pants on fire or something.
Yeah, no, I think that's the position. We'll officially put that in the podcast.
What they have to realise, so, you know, whatever the figure is, 60% or otherwise, is that a lot of our young people, particularly young people we deal with at Generation Liberty, are activists, but not for the kind of causes they're talking about. Activists.
Not for what the conversation writers seem to want. So, of course...
Yeah, because we love activism.
Activism's great. You should be very strongly, fervently in your views. And I think what we've seen with people like Jordan Peterson, with hundreds of people attending IPA events all over the country, over, I think it's 1,100, 1,200 Generation Liberty members.
Nina's nodding her head.
Nina's nodding her head, fact-checking my statistics. We have an extraordinary generation of young people who are extremely engaged with ideas. So I was at Melbourne High earlier this week with John Roskam, and we literally showed the current IPA cover with Jordan Peterson on the front. And oh, Jordan, he's great. We love him. He's great.
Really?
And got IPA sign-ups. And everyone seems to know who Jordan Peterson is. I've had left-wing friends talk about how much they love Jordan Peterson. He's really changing the debate quite substantially.
Absolutely. Let's talk about, in your article in The Spectator Australia, you go on to say what the IPA has found with young people. Do you want to elaborate on what the real facts are?
So the IPA's Growing Freedom Survey, which is now a couple of years old, found that something like 60% of young people are interested in opening their own business, which was a fascinating statistic, shows a kind of self-starter generation, I suppose. And another remark was that once young people enter the workforce, they no longer... as left-wing. So what we found is that amongst young people that enter the workforce, a majority supported smaller government in terms of lower taxes and fuel services. So there's a wide variety of perspective amongst young people. So really saying that a clear majority or something are these progressive social justice activists doesn't really cut the muster.
Yeah, cool. Let's move on to a new topic. So you were in the UK pretty recently. Now you're out of the UK in a very incredible, very... controversial, I guess, time in UK politics with David Davis, the Brexit secretary, I think. He resigned, then a few other people resigned as well. The Brexit thing really came to a head. So what was it like being in Britain for those days? I saw a few photos, like you were walking around a few different press conferences, having a bit of a squiz.
I was having a bit of a squiz.
Is this when Trump was there as well?
I just left when Trump was there. I left the country that day. But I was there when May announced her Chequers agreement. And then over the weekend, as you've said, James, David Davis, the Brexit secretary, resigned. Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary, resigned.
So just on that, so the Chequers thing was basically the terms of the Brexit deal.
So Chequers isn't the terms of the Brexit deal. Chequers is the...
I tried.
Almost. It is worse than that. It is the initial negotiating position of the UK government.
Okay,
so it's not even indicative of the outcome they're going to get. So I was...
So it's like opening offers, I guess.
It's an opening offer, but it's a pretty bad opening offer.
Right.
Which will probably get worse as they go through negotiations. So I went and watched May in the Houses of Parliament she spent about 2 hours answering questions, which was fascinating. It's very much what they call her nothing has changed mode. So during the last election, she released her manifesto and then got in a lot of trouble for a part about aged care. And then she said, nothing has changed, nothing has changed. Everything had changed.
Okay,
it was a disaster. So what in terms of specifically what has changed in this deal, they call it an evolution of the government's negotiating position. The main part of which is the fact that they've committed to what, and I quote, ongoing harmonization with EU rules. So that effectively means that the UK has said, we will follow EU red tape indefinitely. but we will have no say in creating it. So from a distance...
Opening offer.
So even less say when they're actually in the EU.
Yeah, literally this is worse. Yeah, this is actually worse in a lot of respects because they don't even get to say...
That's their ambit claim.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you could talk me down from this, but I'm just letting you know this is where my mind is right now.
Drive a hard bargain, EU.
And as Boris Johnson was secretly recorded saying just before he did resign that he'd like Trump to go in and negotiate because at least Trump would actually know what he's doing.
I was just thinking that.
Get that deal done.
Get the deal done.
What was I going to say? So, sorry, you were... Keep going. I was going to ask a question, but I realised you were sort of still making...
Oh, well, I mean, I can go on for as long as you like, Ben. I'm happy to go. What's your question?
Well, what was the... So you obviously have a lot of friends over there in the sort of Brexit movement, I guess.
Yeah.
What is the feeling? Because I know there's a chance that this could get overturned if she loses her leadership or something like that. Or is there a chance this might not happen in this way?
So the bizarre feeling that I got over there. So I went along to a few meetings with a bunch of friends who are involved with kind of think tanks and similar organisations over in the UK. It is... this feeling that everything is totally screwed. Nobody likes the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
The process of negotiating Brexit is just almost globally seen as a mess, but they can't really seem to do anything about it. And they couldn't seem to get muster the numbers to remove May as leader. A friend did tell me, I don't know the truth of this, but a friend did tell me this was because the MPs didn't want a leadership contest over the summer, which could potentially ruin their summer holidays. And the timelines are so... the timelines are so small at the moment. There's not really time to get rid of her. So they need to negotiate by the October EU summit, some kind of initial agreement. And they've got the formal Brexit March next year. So timelines are extremely tight.
Yeah.
So the feeling is that, there's two camps on the Brexit side. One camp says, well, there's no way they can get a negotiation with what they want in time. This could lead to a hard Brexit, no deal, which is what they're kind of crossing their fingers and hoping for. I'm a little bit skeptical of that view because I think that the kind of disposition of the government and the EU will be to muddle through and they'll reach something very wishy-washy just in time and try to avert a kind of no deal scenario, which means probably, and this is goes back to the point about all they've got so far is a initial plan to go and negotiate. What they're actually going to get out in the end from the EU will probably be much worse in the end.
What about, you know, these people cutting up their memberships and stuff like that to the Conservative Party? Like, can the next leader just say, just tear it up and say, no, this agreement, we're going back on this agreement, we're renegotiating?
It's tough. I think it's tough once they do negotiate something with the EU to then go back on it and renegotiate. So... nothing is impossible. Obviously, a new leader could just try to throw it all up in the air, but it would be relatively unlikely, I think.
So what I don't get with this is, so Theresa May is trying to placate both soft Brexit and hard Brexit people with this kind of checkers agreement. But Brexit seems to have got to a point where it's so contentious that there is no middle ground anymore. You either go the hard or the soft Brexit. So is there any strategy where she goes, if she's like, I know that she wants a soft Brexit, but... like, is she just going to go full soft Brexit after this, or is there any appetite for a hard Brexit?
I mean, it always depends who you ask. I think one of the problems with the parliamentary arithmetic is that there's actually no majority for any kind of Brexit in Parliament. There will always be enough people to vote against any model, be it a harder Brexit or a softer Brexit or a medium rare Brexit or whatever it ends up being. I mean, I call this a flaccid Brexit, really, because it's kind of weak and insipid, but... you can call it whatever you like.
Cool, yeah.
But the end of it is that most of the Labour Party will probably vote against anything the government proposes. And most of the parliament is already Remainers in the first place, so they don't want to see any kind of Brexit. And then you add on a kind of a Tory rebels against the deal, whatever the deal, but whether more Brexiteer rebels or Remain rebels, whatever side it is, you tend to get a very difficult to kind of achieve anything in practice. But I think it's indicative that May isn't really trying for anything particularly strong. She's trying for something more so, I think, what she can get through with the EU to get some kind of deal in time. I mean, May's disposition is not as an ideologue or someone who really believes in anything. She's kind of a systems person. She knows how to deal with matters by just talking everyone around and trying to reach some kind of center point. She's not known as a conviction politician in any sense. So that's where she's sitting. She just thinks this is a practical deal to get to. In terms of being able to negotiate it with the EU, it probably is a more practical deal to get them to say yes to it. But that doesn't mean that it's actually going to achieve good outcomes in the end.
Absolutely. So you say that Theresa May is basically only hanging on because it's a bit too difficult to get rid of her right now.
Yeah.
It's not like there's a huge pro-May camp. If she does go and if, like, you know, something changed and she's out, Who is likely to step in at this point?
So this is the golden question in UK politics is who's next?
Is it Jacob Rees-Mogg? That's all I'm asking. We can wait, then I want the Mogg.
You might be waiting for a little while. There's a few. There's a lot of names mooted. Mogg is one of them. Although
Dan Hannan.
He lacks, well, sadly, Dan Hannan was prevented from getting into Westminster Parliament, which I think is one of the biggest disgraces in UK politics.
By the party.
By the party. So the party blocked his pre-selection equivalent in the UK.
Brexit?
They blocked all the levers from the EU Parliament trying to get into the British Parliament the last election, even though the local area wanted Dan Hannan. So that was
the Conservative Party, right?
That was the Conservative Party. Conservative Party, one might say.
That's a disgrace.
So in terms of the people who are mooted a lot, so obviously Boris Johnson, I think there was a poll out from Conservative Home who does a poll of Conservative Party members that he had gone up quite high in the stakes. Previously, people had talked about Michael Gove. Now, I was previously quite a fan of Michael Gove, but he decided not to resign, like a lot of the other pro-leave people in the cabinet, which I thought was quite disappointing. People talk about Sajid Javid, who's quite Brexiteer these days, at least. And I think it's Home Secretary is the current position. I haven't screwed that up.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
They also talk about people like Jeremy Hunt, who's just become the new Foreign Secretary. But it's really a bit up in the air about who would become leader, particularly since it's a two-step process in the UK Conservative Party. So first of all, you need to be the top two most popular amongst the Conservative Party MPs, and then it goes to the party membership to decide amongst those two about who would be the next leader of the party.
Yeah, and I can imagine that like the eight people that you just listed off also muddies the water into like there's not two people to replace May.
No, it's
like there's a lot of people who are like, I like this guy and that guy, but I can't choose between the two, so therefore let's just keep May.
Yeah, and it's kind of who might be popular amongst the MPs, might be popular amongst the party membership, and that kind of complicates matters for who gets to the final two. It's kind of well understood, and this is apparently May made a joke when she was introducing the Chequers deal to the MPs, introducing her Brexit plan. She said, if you're not careful, I'll go for a walk. And of course, last time she went for a walk in Wales, she decided to call an election, and nobody wants her to call an election as leader because they know that she is a terrible campaigner. So it's pretty broadly understood that they have to get rid of her at some point, even though she wants to hold on, and holding on has been her number one skill as of to date. But there's that global understanding that they have to get rid of her before an election has to be called, and probably are just after the Brexit negotiations. But it defeats the point if you've already negotiated Brexit and then you replace her, you can't fix the deal.
Yeah, I guess like we need to move on to another subject, but like in 20 seconds or less, is there ever going to be like another Brexit vote if they just keep delaying this sort of stuff?
Well, there's a big campaign amongst Remainers for another Brexit vote. I think they would be quite... It's not particularly widely supported at the moment, but it's not impossible.
All right, fair enough. All right, so last thing we got. So this happened today. So administrators at Melbourne's La Trobe University have done an about-face on a decision to block sex therapist Bettina Arndt from addressing a student Liberal Club event, but have told the club they'll have to pay for extra security. So do you want to tell us who Bettina Arndt is and why this speech was so controversial?
Sure. So Bettina Arndt is a... long-time commentator in Australia about issues related to gender relations and sex. She's recently been doing a lot of work on the question of campus sexual assault and sexual harassment. And she was invited by the La Trobe Liberal Club to come and speak about that topic. The initial decision of the university was that Bettina didn't fit the mold of the university's views on that issue, and therefore she couldn't come and speak. They managed to push her and embarrass her a little bit embarrass the university about her coming to speak. But they've still decided to charge a security fee, which is in itself a quite aggressive act.
Do they charge other people for security fees like the other groups?
Not as far as I understand it. So it is clearly an attempt, and we saw this at Sydney University with our own campus events through Generation Libby last year, hosted by Renee.
Yeah, I was just thinking we should fly Renee Gorman into La Trobe University and she'll get to the bottom of things. She'll solve a few problems.
I mean, really what these kind of security fees encourage is what's often called a heckler's veto. It basically means that if you can organise a big enough protest to make security so unaffordable as to make it so the Liberal Club can't pay for it in the first place, then you can effectively stop someone from coming and speaking in the first place. It's actually illegal in the US, so it's unconstitutional to charge specific security fees based upon the content of a speaker's speech. And that's why UC at Berkeley paid something like 600 we want 600,000, then 800,000 for Maya Yiannopoulos to come and speak, and similar amounts for Ben Shapiro to come and speak. So if a university truly believes in debate and free discourse, then I think they really have a responsibility to cover security and not really victim blame the liberal students for having a controversial speaker, but victim blame the people who are there to disrupt and cause problems.
All right, cool. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay, we now welcome to the show for the first time, Aaron Kwong from Hong Kong. You're joining us here with the IPA as part of the Lion Rock Institute Scholarship Program 2018. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, hey, brilliant. So tell us about this Institute Scholarship Program.
Yeah.
So this scholarship program is modeled from Mancal. So they have a scholarship program as well. And the think tank in Perth, they sent students overseas to the other free market libertarian think tanks around the world. So in the Lion Rock Institute, we have sent students to the Reason Foundation, to the Ayn Rand Foundation, and me as a representative, I'm here in Melbourne.
Sunny Melbourne.
Yep.
In July.
In July and freezing Melbourne. So when I took on a plane, it was in Hong Kong like 30 degrees Celsius, and when it dropped off the luggage here in Melbourne, it was freezing.
Yep.
And I'm on my shorts and wrong, big mistake.
No, you can now bring your shorts. What made you come to the IPA? So you mentioned like some people go to Reason, some people go to the Ayn Rand Institute. What made you come to the IPA?
So there are several projects that I'm particularly interested in the IPA.
Mm-hmm.
So one that is that I'm currently working with Morgan on the legal rights project, because I come from a legal background as well. So I can spend time on the research on Australian legislations and how the Acts of the Parliament works, how they scrutinize the bills and try to spot those sneaky clauses that the people may not know that these members of the parliament are sneaking into these, or the government.
Yeah, the fine print kind of thing.
That's a very good summary of what Morgan Beck does. Finds the sneaky things in the legislation that people don't notice. That's good. And how's it like, what's it like working with Morgan? He's not working you too hard, is he?
No. But the legislation is working a lot harder than I thought, because there are a lot of sneaky parts. So first they would have usually... So to give you the context, I'm working on to spot out the legislations with retrospective effect. So basically they say, oh, now I'm going to tell you that this legislation applies backdate, applies 2 years ago.
Yep.
So everything you does, which was legal 2 years ago, is now illegal, and we are now going to put you into some sanctions, some punishments, or some other stuff.
Excellent.
So the sneaky part is that they split these kind of mechanisms into different parts of the legislations. So usually the most obvious is the commencement table, which is usually in the clause 2 of each legislation. So this is the most apparent part. And then last week I came across a small clauses in the middle of the thick legislations, and I find that, wow, this, it says that this act commences in 2004, and this legislation is passed in 2014.
Wow, so a decade of retrospective.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, because that came up in superannuation talks a lot, which was, you know, they were like being taxed afterwards for stuff that they thought they'd already paid. It's like, we're going to shake you down for a little bit more. So,
It's a big thing, as we do in our legal rights audit, which Morgan does every year.
Yeah, absolutely. So have a look out for that one. So let's talk about Hong Kong. So that's where you're from, obviously. So let's talk about like how Hong Kong became such an economic success. What do you reckon the reasons were for that one?
It's very difficult to explain how Hong Kong works as a free economy in a few minutes, but I'll try to summarize it.
You have two and a half exactly.
Oh, right.
And then we're cutting the interview.
So when Hong Kong was still an island and was not claimed by the British, the Chinese didn't really interfere because it was a southern island and the central government is based in Beijing. So until the Opium War broke out, Elliot, which was the superintendent from the British, from the East Indian Company, they think that Hong Kong is a good point for defense.
And so this is like 130 years ago.
Yep.
Right, we're going right back.
Yep. So, but that was a mistake, because Elliot didn't really tell the British government that they're taking Hong Kong. And when the Prime Minister or the foreign minister realized that, oh, they're seizing Hong Kong as a colony, and they decided to replace Elliot with another official, and the official didn't follow the instruction because when he arrived at Hong Kong, he think it is a good place with natural resources, good place to defend in naval supplies, etc. So they took Hong Kong, and the British was not pleased, and they decided to cut off the financial support.
Yep.
So to finance Hong Kong, the two governors, had to find new ways. So they declared Hong Kong as a free port to attract everyone, every traders from all around the world, Portuguese, British, French, and basically everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So they expressly did not give any exclusive benefits or privilege to British. So this is how the free port is born. And we're trying to uphold this free economy. But unfortunately, recently, the government is trying to get more like a parent role to sort of give guidance, and this is not that we're looking for. And the Lion Rock Institute is trying to fight or trying to advocate the benefits of a small government, low tax rate, and less regulation. Just less is more.
I just love that story. It's like a historical accident, basically. Yeah. Britain don't want to know anything about it, and because they don't get involved in it, it turns into this economic powerhouse. That's fantastic. Let's talk about what you were just talking about at the end then, though, how Hong Kong is moving into being... the political culture is being a little bit more left-wing and asking for more government intervention in the economy. Tell us about that and why that's happened and how it's manifesting itself.
So Hong Kong is a crowded place. So since the economic boom in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s,
mm-hmm.
a lot of people is moving to Hong Kong due to mainland China, several events of mainland China. So there is a population boom. So to deal with that problem, the government in Hong Kong has tried to build public housing. And so basically the problem with public housing in Hong Kong is the lowest income households would get the public housing, and the richest person would buy the public house, would get the private housing, would get the flats, private flats. But there is a huge middle layer,
mm-hmm.
and all of them is in between, and they can't really afford the private housing, and at the same time they can't queue for the public housing.
Yeah.
So it is a serious problem, and the people try to blame the government for that because they think that, oh, you started this. You started a public housing problem, and now we have no place to live, so it's the government's fault. So they, instead of stop the government from building more public housing, they are advocating the government to build more public housing, more support, more like a parent role to try to give youth more opportunities, but all initiated by the government. So
yeah, it's like such a classic public reaction to something is to see the government cause a problem and the solution is to have more government.
Yeah.
Like clearly not enough government was had. But from a wider perspective, so the government's getting a bit more involved in the economy. Now, Hong Kong had been a pretty free market paradise kind of thing for decades, and it got so rich based off that. Now that the government's starting to become a bit more involved, is there a leveling off of how much Hong Kong is growing?
Fortunately, not very obvious yet, because the government role has been very, they use a subsidized way. So they put in money, tax money, to spend it on a lot of focus areas. And so the market does not really see at the first time that, oh, now you're putting a lot of money in the tech industry. And they don't see this as a very bad thing because they're giving money to certain industries. But in the long term, there will be wrong decisions. For example, one very funny, interesting example I've read, is, you know, the government is spending a lot of money to encourage app developers to make interesting apps, but they only select a few. It's not determined by the market. So mm-hmm. a good app, usually you just check the download rates in app stores, etc. But no, the government didn't look at that. They just look at pictures. They just look at like PowerPoints and the presentations. And they came up with an interesting app, and they spend more than $1 million Hong Kong, which is like 200,000 Australian dollars on an iPhone app teaching people how to do Tai Chi, like Kung Fu. And I mean, yeah, so these kind of interesting things happen. I think is
were people downloading it, or did it just flop? Because like if I want to learn Kung Fu, I'm not learning it from an app. Like, I'll probably need someone who's like in the room with me.
Yeah. And usually those who want to learn Kung Fu or learn Tai Chi
are already doing it. Yeah.
And they don't really use the phone.
So it sounds like you're having the same problems we're having.
Yeah.
I'm slightly sure. different. There's not a huge kung fu app problem.
Tai Chi. I'm sure there's a bureaucrat somewhere trying to develop it.
Some bureaucrats listening to this going, that would work in Australia. Yeah. Maybe it would.
And hello to all our bureaucratic
listeners. Yeah. Cool. So you've been with the IPA for a few weeks now and been in Australia for a few weeks now. So have you noticed any sort of key differences in what public debate is like in Hong Kong and maybe in China and maybe what the differences are over here? Like, is it more free? Are we talking about different things? What's the sort of flavor you're getting?
In terms of public debate, it always gets to the tension between China and Hong Kong, because people try to attribute every single bit of problem to this sensitive issue, because that is one of the most controversial areas in Hong Kong politics and public debate. So when people, for example, in the housing problem that I just mentioned, rather than focusing on redistribution of the market, of the property market, they will switch the focus back to the Chinese immigrants, and which is also partly the cause. But when we discuss this housing issue, it is always a must that someone bring up this issue of Chinese immigrant and say it's 80% of the cause. And yeah.
You mentioned before, you were talking about how you sort of said, oh, you know, we're trying to stop the government from intervening in the economy more. You're a young person, 22 years old. Is there like a movement, a free market kind of movement in Hong Kong like there is in Australia with Generation Liberty? And you know, you're involved in that?
And Hong Kong is not a very popular voice to have a free market advocacy. But at the same time, maybe Hong Kong, the environment in Hong Kong is very pushing that you have to get a job and mm-hmm. you have to work, actually, just go into the market, just go into the labor market and work. So mm-hmm. It's not just the young generation, even the older generation is like this. They don't really focus on the idea of free market or the idea of socialist policy. We don't really see this split in Hong Kong because everyone is so focused on economic development. So whether you are a free market thinker or whether you're a socialist, so people just, you still go to work, you still apply for jobs, and they don't pay a lot of attention to trying to uphold these ideals. So this is one of the interesting points about Hong Kong's youth, and yeah, in general, they don't really care.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, Aaron, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No problem, thank you for having me.
Cool.
Okay, thank you too, Aaron and Matthew, for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. So let's get into some stories. So I'll start with this one, Pete.
Okay.
The Brisbane Writers' Festival has suddenly become the most controversial event in Australia every year.
Well,
I don't know what's happened, but the Brisbane Writers' Festival just goes off.
Well, I know what's happened.
What's happened?
It's because Lionel Shriver made that speech about cultural appropriation.
Yeah, but there's been this year there's been more.
There's been more.
And Lionel Shriver doesn't have anything to do with it. Her hands are clean. So this one came out. So outspoken feminist writer, this is from the Daily Telegraph, outspoken feminist writer Jermaine Greer mm-hmm. and former New South Wales Premier and Foreign Minister, well, Federal Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, have been told they are not welcome at Brisbane Writers' Festival because they are, quote, too controversial and would, quote, overshadow other writers on the program.
Wow. What a ripper weekend. The Writers' Festival.
We don't want controversial people. Yeah. Right? Get out of here. We want boring. We want, nothing interesting. Yeah. Get out of here.
Well, and who in the world thinks Bob Carr's controversial?
So the reason he got shut down is because his new memoir, Run For Your Life, discusses the, quote, China panic and talks about his relationship with the Israel lobby. So that is why he's too controversial. Like, Bob Carr.
Because aren't...
Labour, New South Wales Premier, Foreign Minister, not 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Too controversial.
And Jermaine Greer is like this, you know, lefty icon.
Yeah, exactly. So it's one of those things where it's like the shifting of what is acceptable as public debate is just getting so crazily skewed that Jermaine Greer, the most hardcore feminist there was 20, 30 years ago, the female eunuch, when that came out, mm-hmm. huge.
Yeah.
That's now, you're too alt-right.
Yeah,
like, because exactly. She's talking about a new book where she includes a call to lower what she sees as, quote, excessive sentences for rapists. Which, you know, is controversial. I get that.
Yep.
But also, I really want to hear what her point is there.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's not getting a whole lot of play, the anti-extensive sentencing. So I would like to hear what she has to say.
And surely it's interesting from a feminist to be running that.
Exactly, yeah.
She's also...
But you don't want that at your writers' festival. Oh, you don't want something as you know, controversial and thought-provoking as that.
We couldn't possibly have something that people might disagree on.
Yeah.
In a way, it's good because more and more people are caught in this net of like not being able to speak at stuff.
Yeah.
So more and more people realise... It's stupid.
Yeah, eventually everyone's going to be in the net just being like, maybe we should be out of the net.
Yeah.
Like, maybe. Just reverse the net.
And another reason, I guess, to be a little bit cut about this is the fact that it is government funded, this.
Yeah, so that's like, I mean, if you want a writers' festival and you don't want Jermaine Greer and it's privately run, like, you know, all right, fair enough.
But when, boots.
Yeah, exactly. But like government, well, the second the government gets involved in the financial means on anything like this, questions start raising.
Well, luckily they're not involved in much, mate.
Exactly. So exactly. So the other part of this is, for me, hopefully this gets to a point where the Brisbane Writers' Festival becomes such a non-attended event because anytime anything interesting happens, it's immediately shut down.
Yeah.
That people start to go, well, maybe we do need to actually provide a service that people want to see.
Yeah. Oh, look, I can't imagine it's that well attended.
No.
When are they going to invite us? We're not controversial. We wouldn't say anything.
We have said three things in this podcast that would get us banned from a Writers' Festival for the rest of our lives.
That, yeah.
And that was before we started recording.
And that, the fact I've never written anything.
That's, the PhD is only days away, Peter.
It is legitimately so close.
Yeah, so that's what I have for that one. So we want to move on to another story.
Yeah, let's do the Burger King pink tax. This was also last week, but just after the podcast came out, seconds after the podcast came out. Burger King in the United States announced that they will be serving Chick fries in a pink box in select restaurants while supplies last, in an effort to raise awareness and counteract the pink tax. Right?
Yeah.
So, James, I hear you ask me, what is the pink tax?
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I forgot my line. What is the pink tax, Pete?
Thanks, James. The pink tax is a tax that targets... And I'm obviously reading this. The pink tax is a tax that targets female consumers and marks the price of products made for women significantly higher than the male equivalent of those products. So they're talking stuff like razors, dry cleaning, toys, vehicle repair, which is an interesting one.
We'll get into that one later.
Is more expensive for women, and they call it the pink tax, and they say it happens 42% of the time. Now, I have done zero research into this pink tax, James, but I can tell you that this is not a thing.
Yeah, well, it's definitely not a tax. Like, it's not like the government sitting there going, like, we need to charge women more.
Yeah, yeah.
What I like is, sorry, it's the like with the Navy, the pink nail polish thing, it's just like, how do we show we're feminist? Pink.
Yeah.
Pink will do it. I just love that tokenism.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, it's like, oh, you know, why? Pink's not a woman's color.
Yeah. Now pink used to be used for boys.
This is adding to our growing file of feminists being completely sexist to women.
Yeah, exactly. So Burger King put a video out talking, like, they had this weird advertising for it. So what they did was they set up like a secret camera style thing where they had all these actors be Burger King people, and they would charge people for the food, and they would charge the women extra.
Yeah, yeah. So they charge
the same
extra
food, and the women would would understandably go,
"Hang on, what?
What are you doing?" And like, it got to a point where the service staff were sworn at. Like, I'm not paying for that. I'm not paying any effing extra.
Oh, really? Boyfriend. I didn't say this.
Yeah, sorry. It started to get a little heated.
Yeah.
Oh, and then the second it got a bit too much, you go like Burger King. Like, it explained to them. And then you had like interviews with people outside the restaurant going, "Oh yeah, it opened my eyes." What I found interesting was a lot of the people that were swearing at the customers, swearing at the staff, were not interviewed after the thing. Yeah.
Different cohort.
Yeah, exactly. So I just want to go, like, how is that the marketing thing? Like, why don't we intentionally aggravate our current customers and make them think we're sexist so that we can do a viral video marketing thing?
Yeah.
That is not going to go well.
It's not a bag. By
the time the video goes out, someone would be like, that girl who had to pay extra is going to be telling hundreds of people, like, don't go to Burger King. They literally just charge me extra for being a woman. Yeah.
Can you imagine, like, the poor 15-year-old kid? All right, you know, little James on your shift today. Now, what you have to do is
To be fair, I'm pretty sure they were paid actors because they stuck to the script and they didn't freak out when they were getting sworn out.
But when it actually happens, though.
Oh, yeah. Like, someone else is like...
Like, I'm earning $6 an hour, mate.
Yeah, that's true.
Hang on, I've got to tell every woman that works in here, she's got to pay more for fries.
Yeah, yeah. I'm on minimum wage, but I've got to tell other people how the patriarchy is putting them down.
Yeah, I've got to explain this complex and incorrect social phenomenon.
No, I'm going like, if anyone's marginalized, it's the person working in minimum wage on Burger King. But it's like explaining to, you know, some soccer mom, it's just like, actually, you're the victim here. Yeah. You are the victim.
Anyway, I don't see how... I mean, look... The pink tax is rubbish.
Yes, and Burger King's a bunch of...
I could do a whole speech about, you know, there's supply and there's demand and there's entrepreneurs. And
this is the end of the show, Pete. We're trying to keep it funny.
Sorry.
Are you saying, and plus, you know, I don't know how that ends. I haven't finished yet. You go, mate.
Okay, cool. So here's one for, this is coming out today. So the New York Times has announced that it has hired Sarah Jeong as the lead technology writer for the website.
Mm-hmm.
So she does a lot of tech stuff, and she also has a pretty active Twitter account.
She does.
And
a potty mouth.
And a potty mouth. Naughty. But yeah, she has some pretty questionable tweets on the subject of white people. And now the outrage mob, they've moved on from James Gunn. They got that scalp. They were coming for Sarah Jeong.
Yep.
So give you a flavor of what she's like. So she wrote these tweets from 2013 to early 2015. So they are a bit outdated, but it's stuff like referring to white people as groveling goblins, which is a fun turn of phrase. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah, it's
and also dogs, but it's stuff like, you know, hashtag cancel white people, dumbass effing white people marking up the internet with their opinions, like dogs pissing on fire hydrants, et cetera, et cetera. Like, not they're not great tweets. And it's a classic, like, you know, you replace white with literally any other color or literally any other social group, and this person would never have a job in media ever again.
Yep.
But because it's white, it's slightly different, and she's still able to get a job in the New York Times. And it's like, we had this last week, and we'll have this week, and by gum, we'll have it next week. But it's just like,
by gum. It's by gum.
I said by gum. Morgan Beck's got in my head. But it's just like the outrage mob is now, the right wing outrage mob is now starting to get scalps, and then the left wing outrage mob is going to get stuff. Now, I get like the obvious, the obvious analogy would be what happened with Kevin Williamson over at The Atlantic, where he got the job at The Atlantic from the National Review.
Mm-hmm.
They found his old stance on abortion and they fired him.
Yeah, well, that was just a political view, though.
Yeah. But basically, so it's like, well, the right wing outrage mob is saying, well, if we don't get Kevin Williamson in The Atlantic, you don't get Sarah Jeong at the New York Times.
Yeah, well, they're not exactly intellectual equals.
Yeah,
but
like, let's assume go back and forth on the subject of groveling goblins.
Yeah.
But it's basically like this tribalism of like, we'll get one of yours if you get one of ours.
Mm.
Which brings us back to everything we discussed last week of, is this really the path we want to go down?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Look, you've taken this a lot more serious than me.
Thank you.
Because
probably not.
I'm just, because didn't the guy, so the guy she replaced retweeted a racist tweet or something. That's why I got the boot, didn't he?
You've done more research than me. I'm taking it more serious.
But, yeah, he retweeted a racist tweet. And so he got the boot, and then they've hired this person that's got
also done that.
Dozens and dozens of tweets.
Well, we need someone with a racist tweet history.
Yeah.
We need someone there. Yeah. We're not going to hire someone.
Can't you just hire someone who knows about technology?
No. That seat is for the person with a bad Twitter history.
Yeah. For the computer nerd that's racist. But why? I don't understand. For me, this is just funny. Like, it's just funny that the New York Times stuffed up a hire. Like, this lady's going to get sacked, right?
I don't think she will. New York Times have come out and they're like, we're sticking with her.
Oh, mate. I'll bet you a Mars bar. This woman will be out.
Absolutely. The Mars bar challenge. Yeah. Winner eats the Mars bar live on air.
Yeah. It's be cracking radio. Anyway, so crumbling for me, this radio is just funny. I don't care anymore.
I don't think she should be fired because I don't. Well, I'm just like, I'm sick of people getting fired over what they used to write on Twitter. If she wrote it yesterday, we can have a discussion.
If she was joking, I don't mind.
Well, it doesn't sound like a joke. Here's another one for you. I just realized why I can't stand watching Breaking Bad or Battlestar Galactica. The premise of both is just white people being miserable.
Yeah, I mean, that's funny.
Yeah, but it's just like, also, Breaking Bad and Battlestar Galactica is the Kevin Williamson Sarah Jeong.
Yeah, so you're coming at this from an entertainment
perspective. Well, and then the other thing that got brought up with this one is like, because she's Asian, can Asian people be racist? Or can anyone be racist to white people? Like, that's now the debate. And I would say yes.
Anyone can be racist to anyone.
Yes. It's not a power thing. Okay, we've got one more for you here. So this one came out of Alberta in Canada. So David, not his real name, they're trying to protect his identity, but he came forward to the paper and he says that he is he changed his gender on his government-issued identification to a woman for the sake of getting cheaper car insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So the story is, he went to an insurance company. They gave him a quote for $4,500 a year when he bought a Chevy. He was young. They thought he was a bit more of a risk because he's a young male. He's probably going to get involved in a crash.
Which is certainly more of a risk.
He's certainly more of a risk. And then he asked what the insurer the cost would be if he were a woman. And the insurer told him that his annual bill would sink to roughly $3,400. So that's a $1,100 difference.
Canadian dollars.
Yes. No, he actually had to pay in Australian. It's quite a weird system.
That is odd. Yeah.
So he changed his gender identification on his government card. to save himself $91 a month. And he said in the article, I'm a man 100% legally, I'm a woman. So first off to you, David, get used to saying that. You're going to be saying that a lot, that exact sentence. Look, I'm a man, but yes, I see the government identification telling you I'm a woman, but I am a man.
Your next interaction with the government's going to be difficult.
Yes. So you have anything on this?
I do. The thing is, this is really... There's a million situations where it would be, I would love to change my gender. The one I'd love to change it the most, outside nightclubs.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say, like, on a sinking ship. Because it's women and children first.
Yeah, that one's a bit more grim. I mean, I'll take your point, but...
I don't know. Like, the nightclubs I've been to, I'd rather be on a sinking ship, to be honest. I'm not a big nightclub guy.
We have to go out more, James. The one... You know, yeah. Sorry, fellas, we got too many blokes.
Oh yeah. Well, actually, fucking free to my government identification card.
You would notice that I am a woman, and these guys are with me, and we can go in. But you know, I don't know how far that would get me.
Yeah, probably not. So my thing is with this, like, this guy is making light of a pretty serious issue, mm-hmm. and I'm just a bit like, come on, mate. I get like $91 a month can be a lot of money to some people, and I can see that point. But yeah, it's the other part of me just goes like. It is a brave civil servant that tells this guy you can't do that. Like, if he wanted to change his... Like, if the civil service gets onto a point where they're like, this guy's just changed his gender to get the identification card,
mm-hmm.
then that's a brave civil servant to tell him no.
Yeah.
My other point is, like, if this loophole exists, someone is going to take it. Like, this isn't not going to happen.
It's when it happened, I'm like, I can't believe this doesn't happen more.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you can get cheaper stuff...
Yeah, well, the pink tax, which we learned about.
Exactly.
That's a good way to... Maybe women should say that they're a man when they're shopping for razors.
Yeah.
And then that way they get charged less.
They'll go, actually, sir.
And then they're back to a woman when they're at Burger King, because then they'll get cheaper fries.
No, that's
no,
more
they get more expensive.
Yeah.
But then they go to Alberta.
The possibility
and then they go
endless.
Back to a woman for car insurance.
You need two. Anyway, but I mean, you've sort of raised the serious points, which I hadn't thought about.
Yeah, so that is it for the show this week. Thank you to Aaron and Matthew for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. If you want to view Matthew's article on our website, that's ipa.org.au, you can learn a bit more about why young people aren't a bunch of raving lefties. So thank you guys for listening to this podcast. Thank you so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify. Make sure that you're getting word out on that one. And through our website. So yeah, keep telling your friends, keep reviewing us on iTunes. Helps us out with the rankings. This is where I would cross to Nina. We miss you, Nina. Please come back.
We need you.
You will be back because, you know, hopefully she'll be back. Like, I don't know how bad the sickness is, but enough to write on Slack. I'm not going to be in today. Anyway, muddied in the waters there. If you want to become a member of the IPA, go to ipa.org.au/join. You can join for as low as $22 a year. You can become a part of Australia's largest voice of freedom. You get a whole bunch of stuff, which Nina has told you about in the past. And if you are already a member of the IPA, but you want to get even more involved, you can always donate to us, but don't tell Greenpeace. But also you can do what you want with that. But anyway,
we'll get you a meeting with Turnbull.
One-on-one. You can ask him about... Oh, we cut that. Sorry. And you'll never know what I just talked about. So, ipa.org.au/donate. If you do want to donate to the IPA, you can go through there. See you guys next week.
See ya. You know, I cherish you, my